Atkins to the homeless. At least, I had thought it was secret. And wasn't it true that I had promised not to catch and release when my wife, the fishing boat captain, was alive? Now she was gone. Maybe I shouldn't have been surprised that Denver thought I was planning to abandon ship. Smiling, I took a step closer to him and laid my hand on his shoulder. Denver, of course you're welcome here. You're welcome here, even when I'm not here. The kids and I consider you part of our family now, and our home is your home. When I promised not to catch and release, I meant it. I thought I could see his throat working. He peered down at the ground for a long moment, and when he looked back up, his eyes were moist. Forever, he said. Then he smiled and turned to hoist another rock.
Chapter 60. I like the big rock up there at Brazo del Dios, the flat one under the leaning oak. It's a comfortable place for me, 'cause when I goes up there, I know Miss Debbie's up there with me. We dedicated the new cemetery in May, and I was mighty glad to see that God blessed the day with a blue sky and a big wide blanket of yellow flowers as far as you could see. There was about 50 people there, mostly the same ones that had come to the burial back in November. We all sang for a while and spent some time talking about God's faithfulness to carry us through this time of grieving. Then I felt like the Lord had given me a word for the people that was gathered there. And when the Lord says speak, ain't much you can do but get up, open your mouth, and see what comes out. Here's what come out that day. Miss Debbie was close enough friend of mine that I prayed and prayed for her day and night, even to the point of offering God life for life. Let me go in, I said to him. Let her stay here, 'cause she more worthy than me to stay here on this earth, and I would be better off to go on up to heaven, 'cause I ain't had no kind of luck down here. But everybody there that day knowed it didn't turn out that way. So I looked at Mr. Ron and Carson and Reagan, sitting over on the bench that Miss Payne put in, 'cause I knowed what I was fixin' to say was gonna be hard for them to hear. I know when somebody you love is gone, that's the last time you feel like thanking God. But sometimes we has to be thankful for the things that hurt us, I said. 'Cause sometimes God does things that hurts us, but they help somebody else. I could see folks nodding their heads. Mr. Ron and them just sat still and quiet. If you want to know the truth about it, nothing ever really ends but something new don't begin, I said. When something ends in our sight, it begins somewhere else where we can't hear it or see it or feel it. We live in two worlds, a physical world and a spiritual world. When Miss Debbie's physical body laid down, her spirit rose up. When we come through this world, we just change form before we go on to the next. I looked over at her grave at where Mr. Ron's ranch hands had tucked some wild roses in an old bucket and set them up by Miss Debbie's head. Then I looked at Mr. Ron again, and I could see him nodding then. He smiled a little, and I thought maybe he was remembering that I had seen Miss Debbie's spiritual body with my own eyes.
Chapter 61. Summer burned through, and September breezed in. Its usual hot winds unseasonably cool. Denver and I spent a lot of time together. We talked about what we'd been through and tossed around the idea of writing our story down. But to tell the story, I needed to know more about Denver's roots. Had the place he'd come from been as bad as all that? I'd been to the plantation in Red River Parish many times in my mind, but the images I conjured had a backlot quality, as though a stagehand were constructing them using props left over from Gone with the Wind. Denver's vocabulary, meanwhile, was short on adjectives, leaving us just one choice. I knew I had to go with him back to Red River Parish to see and touch the place that had produced this man who had changed my life. Denver had another reason for wanting to go back, to close the door on the past. Maybe that's why he clammed up when, in early September 2001, we hopped on Interstate 20 and began our pilgrimage. As we motored east in my new Suburban, the old one had logged too many miles by then, Denver was unusually quiet, and I asked him why.
"I ain't slept much lately," he said. "Been nervous about this trip."
He'd been back before to visit his sister, Hershely, and his aunt, Pearlie May, but in 2000 Hershely had died just a few months before Deborah, leaving Denver feeling permanently untethered from the close family bloodlines that bind us to earth and give us place. We hadn't been driving long before Denver's head hit his chest like a rock falling off a cliff. A minute later, he started snoring. For the next 3 hours, the trip sounded like the scenic route through a sawmill. But once we crossed into Bayou country, something in the air seemed to quicken his spirit. He didn't rouse slowly from sleep, but suddenly sat straight up.
"We nearly there," he said.
The Louisiana air was warm and moist, heavy with the residue of recent rain. Soon we were whipping by cotton fields, and Denver's eyes brightened like those of a young boy passing an amusement park. Outside the windows, acres unrolled, and vast blankets of milky white boles stretched away to meet rows of hardwood trees that formed a distant horizon.
"Looky there now. Ain't that pretty? Just right for picking." Denver shook his head, slowly remembering. "Used to be hundreds of color folks spread out all the way across them fields as far as your eyes could let you look, and the man to be standing by his wagon with his scales writing down how much every one of them picked. These days, all that cotton just sitting there waiting for some big old monster-looking machine to run through there and strip it off. Them machines cost a lot of folks their jobs. It just don't seem right."
Again, Denver's love-hate relationship with his plantation struck me. It was as though he wouldn't have minded so much being stuck in an agrarian time warp if he hadn't seen so much injustice in it. We drove about another half mile, Denver's nose practically pressed against the window.
"Here, Mr. Ryan, pull over right here."
I eased the Suburban onto the gravel shoulder, and the tires crackled to a stop at the edge of the cotton, white rose fanning out like bicycle spokes. Denver stepped down into a muddy aisle, and we walked between the rows, Denver running his hand lightly over the fluffy boles.
"I plowed and chopped and picked the cotton in this field right here for a lot of years, Mr. Ron. A lot of years."
He sounded wistful and tired, then brightened as he let me in on a trade secret.
"This is a good day for picking, 'cause there's a little bit of dampness in the air," he said with a wink. "Makes the cotton way more."
"Don't you think the man figured that out and factored it in?" I asked. Denver paused for a moment, then laughed.
"I expect so."
I pulled a tiny digital camera from my pocket, and Denver slipped into sepia portraiture mode as if I'd thrown a switch. He dropped one knee into the dirt and peered seriously into the lens through designer sunglasses, looking about as much like a former cotton picker as Sidney Poitier. I snapped off several shots, and he was still frozen in his touristy pose when the soulful call of a train whistle floated over the fields.
"Was that your ride you caught out of here?" I asked. Denver nodded solemnly. I wondered how many times he listened to that whistle before he heard it calling his name.
Chapter 62. I was mighty anxious about going back to Red River Parish. I felt better when we crossed the Louisiana line, though. There was something in the air. Memories, spirits. I don't know. Ain't every spirit good, but they ain't all bad neither. Mr. Ron took some pictures of me in one of the fields I used to work. We didn't stay but just a minute before we got back on Highway 1, which shot straight ahead, cutting that cotton in half just like a long black knife. We drove on for pretty good a little piece till I told him, "Turn in right here." He yanked the wheel hard right onto an old dirt road. Set back on the left was the man's house, and on the right was a new house I had never seen before. We bumped down the road pretty slow, kicking up a little mud, cotton spreading all about. Wasn't too long before we saw an old abandoned shack, gray and falling down. All the paint wore off it. "That was the boss nigger's house," I said. Mr. Ron looked at me kind of funny. I guess he was surprised I said nigger. But that's just what we said back then. In case you're wondering what the boss nigger did, it was just what it sounded like. He was the colored man that bossed all the other colored folks around. Mr. Ron kept driving till I said, "Stop right here." Right there next to the road on the other side of the wire fence was a two-room shack. Looked like it was fixing to fall down any minute. There was weeds crawling up over it. Wasn't no front door, just a yellow jacket's nest as big as a hubcap. "That's where I stayed," I said, kind of quiet. Wasn't no place to pull off, so Mr. Ron just stopped the Suburban in the middle of the road. We got out, climbed over the fence, and poked around a bit, pushing through the high weeds, peeking in the windows. Wasn't no glass in them, never had been. Wasn't nothing inside but cobwebs and yellow jackets and heaps of trash. I wondered if any of it was mine, but after so much time had gone by, I reckon not. Mr. Ron just kept shaking his head. "I can hardly believe you lived here all those years," he said. "It's awful, worse than I thought." Looking at that shack, I could see myself as a young man, so proud to have my own place. I didn't realize it wasn't no bigger than a tool shed. I could see myself on the man's tractor in that field yonder. I could see myself tending a hog out back of the shack and scraping to make the meat last. I could see myself rolling out of the bed every morning before sunrise, tending the man's cotton year after year and for nothing. When Mr. Ron asked could he take some pictures of me in front of that shack, I let him. But I only smiled on the outside.
Chapter 63. When Denver showed me where he used to live, I could hardly process it. Made of gray plank lumber, it was half the size of the shotgun shacks I'd grown up seeing in Corsicana, nearly small enough to fit in the back of a long bed pickup truck. I stared up the road the way we'd come and remembered passing the man's house, a big white country house, clabbered with a gracious porch complete with swing. The contrast disgusted me. Denver didn't say much as we poked around the place. Then he suggested we move on down to the house where Hershey had lived. We climbed back into the Suburban, and as we rolled over the red dirt road, he told me how the man had let her live in the house until she died, even though she didn't work the fields anymore and couldn't pay rent. Denver seemed to think that was mighty decent of him. For a moment, my mind drifted down a road it had traveled before. What kind of man was the man?
For decades, one man kept sharecroppers barefoot and poor, but let a little colored boy earn a brand new red Schwinn. Another man let an old black woman live on his place rent-free long after she'd stopped working in the fields. A third man kept Denver ignorant and dependent, but provided for him well beyond the time he probably could have done without his labor. It seemed a throwback to the slavery-era doctrine called paternalism, the idea that black people were childlike and incapable of living free and therefore better off as slaves. That it had happened to Denver in the mid-20th century shocked me. About a quarter mile down the road, we stopped at Hershey's. It was a real house, what you could see of it. Tarpaper shingles and gray, peeling eaves stuck up from a 10-foot tangle of Johnson grass like the last dried deck on a sinking ship. Behind the house, 30 yards off, a pea-green bayou slunk from left to right. I shut down the Suburban, and Denver and I got out to survey the place. At one time, Hershey's house had worn a coat of white paint trimmed in baby blue, but today it looked like a bomb had exploded nearby. All the windows were broken out, trash and glass, mostly wine bottles, lay scattered in the few patches of bare ground that weeds had not yet overrun. The house sagged askew from sawed-off bois d'arc tree stumps, and the porch was rotten and falling away. From what we could tell, Johnson grass shrouded the house on all four sides. The parts of the windows we could see spilled forth only darkness. Denver looked at me with a sly grin. You scared to go in? No, I'm not scared. How about you? Me? I ain't scared of nothing. With that, we breaststroked through the towering weeds like men on safari and jumped up on the porch, having to, since the steps had fallen off. Using the few remaining boards like stepping stones, we picked our way to the front door, which hung open, reminding me of a hungry mouth. Denver went in first, and I heard rodents skitter for cover as I followed him into a small parlor that had been ransacked, then used as a dump. A divan was piled high with trash, broken chairs, and an old record player. A table and a dresser stood against the wall at odd, unlivable angles. Clothes littered the floor. A thick layer of dust lay over it all. I took a step, kicking paper, and looked down to find an old pile of mail. On the top, a letter from the city of Fort Worth, addressed to Denver Moore in Red River Parish, Louisiana. The date, March 25th, 1995. I started to hand it to him, but he waved me off. You open it. You know I can't read. I slipped a thumb under the yellowed envelope flap, and the glue gave way like dust. Shaking out a single sheet inside, I unfolded what turned out to be a warrant for driving without a license. Squinting in the dim light, I read aloud, Dear Mr. Moore, we have a warrant for your arrest for the amount of $153. We broke out laughing, the sound falling strangely in the dark, ramshackle house. I tucked the letter in my pocket, a keepsake. Reaching down, I scooped up another letter, this one addressed to Hershey from the publisher's clearinghouse, informing her that she may have won $10 million. Looked like she'd died on the eve of her lucky break. Hershey's bedroom was eerie, like walking through a life suddenly abandoned. Family photos still sat on the bureau. Her clothes still hung in the closet, and the bed was made. Denver looked at the bed and smiled. I remember one time Hershey was watching some other folks' kids, and she wanted to make them mind. So we come in here and close the door, and she told me to jump up and down on the bed and holler like she was beating the tar out of me. She wanted to make them other children do what she say. The memory turned him melancholy, but the moment passed quickly. Come on, he said. I want to show you Hershey's bathtub. Denver had told me about the tub when he bought it for Hershey. Using the money,
I'd insisted he keep from his Colorado adventure. Ursula bathed in it, but had never had it hooked up to running water, and she kept it on her screened-in back porch. Denver and I picked our way out there, straining to see in the house's dark center. Boards groaned and creaked under our feet, and the hair on my neck twitched a little. When we reached the porch, a little more light streamed in through the Johnson grass that crawled up surrounding the screens, and sure enough, there sat Hershey's bathtub, crawling with spiders. Only the tub half of the porch was screened in and open to the air. On the other end, some kind of extra room, dark and boarded up, jutted out toward the bayou. "Hershey was mighty proud she had this new tub," Denver said. "Come on, I want to show you the pot-bellied stove where she heated up water to take a bath." He started toward the kitchen, but froze and looked back at me. "Did you hear that?" I stopped and listened in the weird silence. Then I heard footsteps, like heavy boots. Worse, I heard heavy breathing. Someone was stalking toward us from inside the boarded-up room, 15 feet away, but it didn't sound to me like someone. It sounded like something. The hair on my neck stirred again, and I looked at Denver. Thump, thump, came the steps, then the creaking of a door handle. Denver's eyes widened until they seemed the size of pie plates. "Let's get out of here," he whispered. We bolted off the porch, back through the inky house, hurtling piles of trash and upended furniture. I barely beat Denver to the front door. We burst out. 1, 2. I leaped over the rotting porch planks and flew off the front porch. Denver airborne behind me. We hit the ground running, but a few feet from the house, pulled up and stopped. I stared at Denver, and he stared back, both of us panting with relief. Then we broke into nervous laughter. "Do you think that was a possum or coon?" I said lightly, as though neither of us had really been all that scared. "Mr. Vaughn, ain't no such thing as a 200-pound possum or coon that wears boots and walks like a man." I picked up a big stick and looked back at the front porch, ready to do battle with whatever emerged. Then, instead of calling it a day, Denver and I did just what they do in the horror movies. We edged around the side of the house toward the bayou. I was fully prepared to see some kind of boot-wearing swamp monster lumbering back to his gooey lair. Less than a minute had passed when suddenly every hair on my body stood at attention. Denver and I locked eyes, transmitting shared terror. "Let's get out of here." This time we both said it and raced back to the Suburban in a dead sprint. We jumped in, slammed the doors, and punched the lock buttons. I turned the ignition key, and nothing. My brand new car wouldn't start. Over and over, I cranked the key forward. Denver's head swiveled between the key and the house. The key, the house. His eyes grew wider. He punched the imaginary gas pedal on the passenger side, willing the thing to start. The engine coughed and sputtered as though out of gas, but the tank was nearly full. "Do you believe this?" I said, my voice up an octave. "Sure do," he said and swallowed. A full minute passed as I tried the ignition again and again. The hair on the back of my neck was now so rigid the follicles hurt. The engine coughed and spit and finally caught, but when I pushed on the gas, nothing. Terrified. I wouldn't have been surprised if the swamp monster we hadn't seen out back roared out from under the truck, crashed through the windshield, and ripped our throats out. I'd never before felt such fear. It was visceral, palpable. With the engine barely turning, I jerked hard on the gear shift, and we rolled forward, my $40,000 SUV limping like an antique buggy. About a quarter mile down, the road dead-ended. I bumped off into a muddy pasture to turn around, but the engine stalled. As I cranked the ignition again and again, Denver kept glancing up the road, looking for the something. Finally, the Suburban sputtered to life again, and I pulled back onto the road, the engine popping and sputtering like an old tractor with a tank of bad gas. We crept along like that until we passed Hershey's house. 100 yards later, the engine roared to life, then settled into a kittenish purr, gauges perfect, as if nothing had happened. At that, Denver erupted into a belly laugh, so all-consuming that if he'd been on an airplane, the oxygen mask would have dropped to help him breathe. He gasped and howled, tears squirting, until he finally blurted, "Now, Mr. Ron, you got a story to tell. A good one. You sure do." Then, as if an eraser had wiped the smile off his face, he turned dead serious and stared into my eyes. "Nothing keeps you honest like a witness," he said.
Chapter 64. When we heard them steps stomping toward us from inside that boarded-up room that wasn't fit for no human, I thought my eyeballs was going to pop out of my head. We hightailed it out of there like nobody's business. But when I was running, I started feeling a little silly, thinking maybe what we heard could have been a vagrant or just somebody holed up in Hershey's house. But when we slid around the side of the house and my skin started crawling, I was pretty sure it was something, not somebody. And when Mr. Ron's brand new car started acting like a spooked horse, I knowed it for sure. After we got past Hershey's house, I told Mr. Ron that it wasn't the first time I seen strange things on the plantation. Like that time my auntie, Big Mama's sister, made it rain. Looking back on it, I think auntie was what you might call a spiritual healer. Like a medicine man, except she was an elderly woman. She lived out there near the bayou, about half a mile from Big Mama's. And I used to go over there and see her sometimes. I was scared of her. She always wore a long, dark skirt and a rag around her head. And when she laughed, sounded like a flock of birds scared and flying away. But Big Mama made me go to show my respect and also to help Auntie gather up the fixings for her medicines. She used to take me with her down by the swamp where she'd be gathering up some leaves and roots. We go in the evening just when the sunset was given over to a cool twilight and take us a little basket. I carry it for her, picking our way through the cypress trees while the bullfrogs and crickets were tuning up. I always kept one eye out for gators. "Now, little buddy, this here's for taking the pain out of a wound," she'd say, pulling up a root and shaking off the earth. "And this here's for pneumonia." She must have known 20 different kinds of roots and what have you. And what she know must have been a secret, 'cause she made me promise I wouldn't tell nobody what she was pulling and where she was pulling it. Auntie lived by herself. She had a room in her house with a big table in it, covered with jars in all kinds of sizes. "See them jars?" she told me one time. "Yes, ma'am." "In each one of them, I got something for anything that happens to you." Folks used to go see Auntie when they were sick, but if folks wasn't sick, they stayed away. I wasn't surprised. She had some kind of spiritual thing going on in that house. Every time I went in there, she made me sit on a little stool in the same spot, even facing in the same direction, like she didn't want me to mess up whatever voodoo she had going on in there. One day when I was sitting on that stool, she sprinkled some powder on the wood floor. Then she walked over to me and stared into my eyes and said real low, "Do you believe I can make it rain?" I looked out the window and didn't see nothing but blue sky. "I don't know," I said, half scared but kind of curious. "Sit there," she said. Then Auntie picked up her broom and started sweeping that powder around on the floor, humming a little tune like no song I ever heard. She hummed and swept, brushing at the floor with small strokes. She swept that powder all around the front room, then swept some onto the front porch, humming all the way. Then she called to me, "Little buddy, walk out on the porch." I did, and this is the truth. A cloud had formed right over the house. Just one cloud, not a whole sky full. And right when I looked up at it, that cloud flashed with lightning and thunder cracked. I could feel it rumbling up underneath the house. Then it come a rain right there on the porch. Auntie turned her face up into the sprinkling drops, smiling a little like she knowed a secret. "I told you," she said. "Except for Mr. Ron, I never told nobody about that, 'cause most people gonna say that's just superstition. They'd rather pretend things like that don't happen."
Chapter 65. I guided the miraculously healed Suburban back over the red dirt road that eventually spit us out onto Highway 1. We drove a mile or so looking for another dirt road, just a slit in the weeds, really, so narrow we missed it a couple of times and had to double back. It was the road to Aunt Pearlie May's house. In the 1960s, she'd moved into a shotgun house out closer to the plantation and had lived there ever since. As I eased the truck along the pitted trail, bumper-high Johnson grass parted to reveal a slice of America that most Americans never see. Six shotgun shacks squatted in a clearing in the woods, lined up like prisoners held hostage from another era. No yards divided the lots. Instead, junk huddled in heaps around every house, old tire, beer cans, car seats, rusted mattress springs. In the middle of the road lay the bloated carcass of a dead mongrel dog. In front of one house, a young black man and woman watched us from a molting sofa someone had dragged out into the dirt. The woman pulled on a cigarette as chickens pecked around her feet. Smoke boiled into the air from one yard where two kids tended a pile of burning trash. Nearby, a girl pinned wet laundry to a rope that ran between the house and a dead tree. She looked about 12 and was pregnant. I slowed down as if driving past a bad accident. The residents stared at me like I was an alien. "Stop right here," Denver said. There, sitting on a tree stump beside the road, was an elderly woman sucking on a can of beer at 3 in the afternoon. Dressed in men's trousers and a stained T-shirt shot through with holes, she lit up when she saw Denver. He got out of the truck and hugged her, then handed her a $5 bill. With a wheezy giggle, she poked her hand through one of the holes in her shirt and tucked the money in her bra. "Y'all come on in the house," she rasped. "I got some greens on the stove, and they's fresh." Denver politely declined and hitched himself back into the Suburban. "She ain't no kin," he said, "just a friend of Pearlie May's." We crept down to the last house, past a man working on a tractor. He had disassembled the machine into several dozen pieces near his front door, which wasn't really a door at all, but a red plaid blanket tacked up to keep the flies out. Pearlie May's house sat at the end of the row. A dozen or so plastic lawn chairs littered the dirt out front, punctuated with huge pyramids of empty, natural light beer cans stacked like fire logs. Next to the front porch lay a mountain of brown Garrett snuff jars, hundreds of them. From the end of a long chain, a spotted mongrel dog yapped at a flock of unperturbed chickens who knew just how long the chain was. "Little buddy," Aunt Pearlie May said when we walked up to her porch. "Lord, if you ain't got your daddy's nose." Denver gave her a hug, not a big one. Then she leaned on the rotten porch railing and aimed a four-letter word at the barking hound. "Shut up, dog, before I come out there and shut you up." She turned then and smiled at Denver, but her weathered face telegraphed concern over my presence. To ease her mind,
I nodded at the snuff can mountain and told her that my grandmother and great aunts had dipped Garrett snuff. That seemed to make her feel better. Aunt Pearlie May invited us into her parlor, a space that measured about 6 feet by 8 feet and was wallpapered in a patchwork of Christmas wrap along with three pictures of Jesus. Somehow, someone had managed to shoehorn two worn-out love seats into the room and arranged them facing each other. When Denver and I sat down across from Pearlie May and her husband, our knees touched. We chatted about this and that, except for the husband, who sat across from me expressionless and never said a word. Later, Denver said that was the friendliest he'd ever seen him. "Y'all come out back and see my hogs," Pearlie May said after a short visit. "I'm thinking about selling them off. Want you to see them in case you know anybody wants to buy them." We unfolded ourselves and covered the distance to the back door in three long steps. Outside, two corpulent hogs snuffled and grunted, wallowing in mud up to their bellies. Pearlie May made a little porcine sales pitch, then yacked cheerfully about her new indoor toilet. She'd had it installed in 2001 and paid for it with proceeds earned over a lifetime of bootlegging natural light beer through her bedroom window for a buck a can. Said she still mainly used her outhouse, though, since all the kinks hadn't been worked out in her indoor plumbing yet. We left just before dark, and as we drove away, the images of poverty and squalor burned themselves into my brain like hated tattoos. I could hardly believe places like that still existed in America. I thanked Denver for taking me there, for taking my blinders off. "Mr. Ron, they're living better than I ever did when I was living here. Now you know it was the truth when I told you that being homeless in Fort Worth was a step up in life for me." Chapter 66. By the second week in September, more than $500,000 had poured into the mission. A couple of days before the groundbreaking ceremony for Deborah's chapel, Mary Ellen called me. She wanted to share with me something that Jesus had told his disciples, a metaphor for his own death, recorded in the Gospel of John. "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the earth and dies, it remains by itself, alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." In prayer that morning, Mary Ellen said she felt God whispering to her heart, "Deborah was like that kernel of wheat." The next day, Denver dropped by for a visit. Sitting across from me at my kitchen table, as he had so many times, he said nearly the same thing, but in the language of a country preacher. "Mr. Ron, all good things must end," he said. "And nothing ever really ends that something new don't begin. Like Miss Debbie. She's gone, but something new is beginning." 3 days later, on September 13th, we gathered to break ground on New Beginnings, the new mission. Only 2 days before, terrorists had crashed a pair of passenger jets into the World Trade Center, changing America forever. Carson lived in New York City. It had taken me hours to reach him by phone as I sat before the live TV news coverage, stunned at the news, knowing it was now not only my own world that tragedy had changed forever. The nation ground to a halt, but in honor of Deborah, the mission board decided to go ahead with the groundbreaking. I followed the familiar route she and I had driven so often to the mission, past train tracks and derelict buildings and underpasses that doubled as outhouses for the homeless. The first time Deborah and I traveled east to Lancaster, she dreamed of bringing beauty there. And she had, but not in the way she'd first imagined. Instead of lining the sidewalk with picket fences, she'd fenced out fear, prejudice, and judgment, creating with her smile and open heart a sanctuary for hundreds. Instead of planting yellow flowers, She'd sown seeds of compassion that changed hearts, mine and Denver's, only two among them. So I stood with Reagan, Denver, my mother, Tommy, and nearly 100 friends that day under God's blue canopy, using a ceremony program to shield myself from the sun. We listened as Mayor Kenneth Barr and State Senator Mike Moncrief spoke of the hope that this new mission would bring to the homeless of Fort Worth. Behind them, a 10-foot patch of red dirt lay exposed, and 4 shovels festooned with blue ribbons stood like soldiers, ready to turn over the soil, ready to receive the kernel. Now, on East Lancaster Street stands a new mission that includes new services for the needy, residential rooms for women and children, and the Deborah L. Hall Memorial Chapel. Both are a memorial to a woman who served the city, a woman God took home so that, in his strange providence, the sick and the lost might find greater refuge and hope. Bitterly, I wondered if he could have managed to build them without taking my wife. It could have been called God's Chapel, and Deborah Hall could have served him there. I remembered what C.S. Lewis said of the clash between grief and faith. "The tortures occur," he wrote. "If they are unnecessary, then there is no God, or a bad one. If there is a good God, then these tortures are necessary, for no even moderately good being could possibly inflict or permit them if they weren't." The pain of losing Deborah still brings tears, and I cannot mask my profound disappointment that God did not answer yes to our prayers for healing. I think he's okay with that. One of the phrases we evangelicals like to throw around is that Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. I believe that, which is why I know that when my faith was shattered and I raged against him, he still accepted me. And even though I've penciled a black mark in his column, I can be honest about it. That's what a relationship is all about. Still, I can't deny the fruit of Deborah's death. Denver, the new man, and the hundreds of men, women, and children who will be helped because of the new mission. And so, I release her back to God. The Sunday after the groundbreaking, Denver and I pulled into the parking lot of the new Mount Calvary Baptist Church, a church in a depressed neighborhood in southeast Fort Worth. Pastor Tom Franklin had heard Denver speak at Deborah's memorial service and for months had kept after me to try to convince him to come and preach at his church. Finally, Denver agreed. I had prayed for a standing-room-only crowd, but by the looks of the parking lot, folks were standing somewhere else that morning. If Abraham Lincoln had been black, Pastor Tom would have been his twin. Gray-haired and bearded, he greeted us at the church door, pulling us each into a lanky hug. Peeking into the sanctuary, I could see only a few people scattered through the pews. Pastor Tom read my thoughts. "Don't worry, Ron. Everyone the Lord wants to be here will be here." As the service began and the tiny congregation filled the air with old spirituals, Denver and I huddled on the back row. Pastor Tom had wanted me to introduce Denver from the pulpit, but spent a few minutes telling his life story first. As I suspected, Denver wasn't having any of that. During the singing, he and I huddled on the back row to negotiate. "It ain't nobody's business how I got here," he whispered. "Sides, I don't want to tell them about me. I want to tell them about the Lord." "So what do you want me to say?" He paused and stared down at the Bible, laying on the bench next to me. "Just tell them I'm a nobody that's trying to tell everybody about somebody that can save anybody. That's all you need to tell." And so, when the singing stopped, I walked down front and said just that. Then Denver took the pulpit. At first his voice quavered a bit, but it was loud, and the longer he preached, the louder and stronger it became. And like a magnet, his voice pulled people in off the street. By the time he wiped the sweat off his face and sat down, the pews were nearly full. Like a cannonball, Pastor Tom shot out of his seat into the pulpit, raising his arms toward the people. "I believe God wants Denver to come back and preach a revival," he said. The congregation, most of whom had been drawn into the sanctuary by Denver's voice, exploded into applause. My mind flashed to Deborah's dream, her seeing Denver's face and recalling the words of Solomon. "There was found in the city a certain poor man who was wise, and by his wisdom he saved the city." Again, something new had begun. Something I was certain had my wife dancing for joy on streets of gold.
Chapter 67. Like I said before, when Mr. Ryan promised he wasn't going to catch and release me, I was skeptical. But listen to this. Not too long after I preached at Pastor Tom's church, Mr. Ryan asked me, would I move in with him? And you ain't going to believe where. At the Murchison Estate in Dallas, in a mansion where Mr. Ron said United States presidents, movie stars, and even a fella named J. Edgar Hoover used to stay. I guess the Murchisons at one time was the richest folks in Texas, and some of the richest in the whole country. In 2001, Mrs. Lupe Murchison passed on, gone to join her husband, and their kin was wanting Mr. Ron to live on the estate and sell off all their art. They had hundreds of pictures and statues and what have yous. Mr. Ron said it was all worth about $1 zillion. So he hired me to live on the estate with him and be the night watchman. That suited me, 'cause I was ready to work for a living and earn some money of my own. The mansion was real old and grand, built in the 1920s, Mr. Ron said. A couple of nights while I was guarding it, I met some ghosts wandering around. Not long after, I moved into the mansion with Mr. Ron. I found some paints in the garage and decided to paint me a picture. I was getting paid to guard all them silly-looking pictures by a fella like Picasso. Then looked to me like they was very hard to paint. Sure enough, it only took me a couple of hours before I had made a picture of an angel that was ever bit as good as some of them I was guarding. Mr. Ron liked it a lot when I showed it to him the next morning. "How much do you want for it?" he asked me. $1 million, I said. $1 million, he said, laughing. "I can't afford your paintings." "Mr. Ron, I ain't asked you to buy it. I'm asking you to sell it like you sell them other million-dollar pictures." After that, though, I showed my angel pictures to Sister Betty, and she said it was her favorite painting she had ever seen, so I gave it to her. She's like an angel to me anyway. Then Mr. Ron set me up my own studio in the room right next door to Lupe Murchison's five-car garage. I guess I painted over 100 pictures by now. Sold some of them, too. Carson and Mr. Ron have done sold out most of the Murchison art. And somebody bought the mansion, too. Now we're living in another house on the estate while they sell the rest. During the day when I ain't working, I carry Miss Debbie's torch, the one the Lord told me to pick up so she could lay it down. I still go down to the lot and help Sister Betty and Miss Mary Ellen. Sister Betty's getting on in years, and I worry about her. Once a month, I preach at the Right Way Baptist Church. I take clothes over to the homeless people and take care of my homeboys that's all still on the street. Maybe give them a few dollars. I do some traveling, too. In January 2005, me and Mr. Ron went to the presidential inauguration. Mr. Ron was invited, and he asked me to go with him. That was the first time I ever went on an airplane. We landed in a snowstorm, but I didn't know I was supposed to be scared. So there we was, on the White House lawn, sitting on the front row, and I'm looking around at all the astronauts and war heroes and wondering, how in the world did a fella like me wind up in a place like this? It was something I never even dreamed of. I wasn't that far from the president, but I wanted to check him out a little better, so I got up out of my seat and walked up closer to where he was sitting, getting ready to make his speech. But this Secret Service man, a black fella like me, held up his hand. "Sir, where are you going?" "I'm going to walk right up here and see the president," I said. He looked at me kind of firm. "No, you're close enough." Later that night, me and Mr. Ron went to the inaugural ball. The president and his wife was dancing right there in front of me. I had on a tuxedo and a bow tie. I felt pretty good about that. The next day, I got to stand on the steps at the Lincoln Memorial. I remember way back when I was a little bitty fella, Big Mama told me about how President Lincoln freed black people from slavery. That's why they shot him. I felt mighty blessed to be able to go see the president. Me and Mr. Ron done some other traveling, too. I've been to Santa Fe and San Diego. Back home in Dallas, we still go to restaurants and cafes, the ranch and rodeos, and to church on Sundays. All in all, we's pretty tight. A lot of times, we'll sit out on the back porch at the Murchison Place or out on the patio at Rocky Top, looking at the moon shining on the river and talking about life. Mr. Ron still got a lot to learn. I'm just messing with you. Even though I'm almost 70 years old, I got a lot to learn, too. I used to spend a lot of time worrying that I was different from other people, even from other homeless folks. Then after I met Miss Debbie and Mr. Ron, I worried that I was so different from them that we wasn't ever going to have no kind of future. But I found out everybody's different. The same kind of different as me. We're all just regular folks walking down the road God done set in front of us. The truth about it is, whether we is rich or poor, or something in between, this earth ain't no final resting place. So in a way, we is all homeless, just working our way towards home.
Epilogue. Debbie's final words to me were, "Don't give up on Denver. God is going to bless your friendship in ways you cannot imagine." When I returned from nearly 4 months in Italy, Denver moved in with me, Reagan and Carson. As you probably figured out by the end of the book, we became a family, each searching for whatever path would help us shed the sackcloth and ashes of grief and feel the joy of sunshine on our faces once again. The Murchison Estate in Dallas was where we left you at the end of the story. Reagan and Carson moved out after a year or so and left Denver and me there to sort out how to peacefully coexist under the same roof. Peaceful was the operative word, for things were often rocky as Denver had to learn responsibility and accountability, two words that never existed in his previous life as king of the jungle. Together we wrestled with his demons, and I guess a few of mine as well. There were major victories and a few painful defeats, but we endured and grew closer than brothers as we shared a common goal to carry Miss Debbie's torch. Denver continued to show his wisdom that so often confounded those whom the world would consider wise, especially me. Without books, notes, or syllabi, he taught me, and anyone who stopped to listen, raw life lessons honed from years in prison and a life lived on the streets and in hobo jungles. In a moment of sure brilliance, he concocted a 30-day plan that could potentially end homelessness in America. It confounded the city leaders of one of the largest cities in America, and we outlined it in our follow-up book, What Difference Do It Make? Now, living in a luxurious home, he suddenly felt the urge to help those who were still trapped in what he referred to as the devil's prison of helplessness. His homeboys, as he referred to them, on the streets were jealous of his newfound rock star status afforded him as a New York Times best-selling author. Maybe it was the white-on-white Escalade with custom rims. Maybe it was the black fedora with the silk hatband that held a small stone picked up on Mount Calvary and brought back to Texas by his preacher friend, O.S. Hawkins. Whatever it was, when Denver returned, almost daily, to the streets he ruled for nearly 25 years, he drew a crowd. Sitting on the curb by his old dumpster that served as his refuge for years, he freely shared dollar bills, cigarettes, and street-honed advice to compatriots sipping the dregs of nearly empty half-pints fished out of gutters and trash cans. Most mornings, before he began his daily trek into the hood carrying Debbie's torch, he invited me into his art studio to share his latest creations. This day he seemed especially excited as he walked ahead of me a little faster than normal. "Mr. Ron, I done come up with a sign for the homeless that's gonna do 'em more good than hungry, God bless." He grabbed the freshly painted cardboard and held it up to his chest to hide his writing. Then, with his famous wink and nod, he asked, "What did this say?" As I read aloud the misspelled words, "Ask me about my plan to end homelessness," he began laughing hysterically. When he caught his breath, he flipped it over to reveal his brilliant plan. "Let me move in with you." Shortly after our book release in 2006, we were invited to Pasco, Washington, to share our story with a large church. It would be our first large venue event in a place about as far as you could get from DFW Airport and still be in the continental United States. As you can imagine, it required making connections through several airports, which proved to be a daunting task for Denver. For more than 25 years on the streets of Fort Worth, time never mattered to a man who had no place to be and plenty of time to get there. Airports and connecting flights proved to be higher mountains to climb than those he faced in Colorado when he delivered all of my daughter's worldly goods to the Young Life camp where she worked. Denver moved at the speed of his choosing, which was only slightly faster than standing still. Trying desperately to hurry him along as the PA system was calling our name for final boarding, he stopped dead in his tracks, refusing to move until I turned around, circled back, and got in his face. "Ever heard of running?" I asked. "Now just hold on a minute, Mr. Ron. You see all them airplanes sitting out there on the concrete? If we miss ours, we'll just get on one of them." "It doesn't work that way," I barked in frustration. "Well, it do on freight trains, and I'll bet you if we get on one of those other aerial planes and sit there long enough, we're going to eventually get to where we're supposed to be." A few weeks later, we dined by the ocean in San Diego. The next week, we were in Naples, Florida, having breakfast at an oceanside resort cafe. "I thought you said you was a businessman," he asked, a little irritated, as if it had come out of left field. "I still am one," I replied.
Then why didn't you take care of your business the last time we was here so we didn't have to come back so soon?
We've never been here before, I told him. We sure was. Just last week we were sitting right here looking at the ocean.
Denver, that was California. Now we are in Florida, which is 3,000 miles away on the other side of the United States.
He scratched his head to gather his thoughts. Then with one eye cocked, he replied, "You mean to tell me that Florida went out and got themselves an ocean, too, so they could be like California?"
As promised to Debbie on her deathbed, Denver and I picked up her torch for the homeless and carried it across America, telling our story and raising money for the homeless, hoping to make a difference. On the days we were not on the road, telling our story to large audiences in an attempt to get them to turn loose large denominations of folded presidents, as Denver called them, we spent time together in our art studio. After a bumpy start, Denver grew to love painting, and his fans stood in line to buy his latest works. I took up making sculptures inspired by Calder. My friends called them Halders. We often worked together late into the night, taking breaks to smoke cigars out under beautiful starry skies, reminiscing about Miss Debbie, and hoping to see her star go blazing across the sky. As Denver's popularity as an artist continued to grow, he got his own dealer who asked to do a show featuring both our works. The gala opening was packed with a line down the sidewalk waiting for space to view the art and meet the now famous man. As the last glass of wine was served and the last morsels of cheese sat on empty silver trays, we surveyed a cosmic display of red dots by every painting Denver had painted. He had accomplished what every artist dreams of but seldom sees, a completely sold-out show. I had sold zero sculptures. After relishing a few moments of his success, he told his dealer to send all the money to homeless children in Haiti. Of course, we spent time at Rocky Top, where I continued my pursuit of being a cowboy, not anything that interested Denver. He would joke that white boys on horses carrying ropes were not anything he wanted to watch. Instead, he took long walks down by the Brazos River, and I'd usually find him late in the afternoon sitting on the big rock at the foot of Miss Debbie's grave. In 2009, 3 years after this book was published, we followed up with our second book, What Difference Do It Make? Stories of Hope and Healing. Denver, Lynn Vincent, and I huddled up to write more stories not included in the first book, some that occurred later, and others that were reflections on the hundreds of letters and emails we received from readers whose lives had been impacted by our book. Hopefully, you've read What Difference Do It Make, or will, as it is full of Denver stories that are profound and often very funny. In late 2010, after more than 5 years on the road and 400 events we had done together, Denver's health began to fail. We took fewer engagements, and I found time to pursue love. I became engaged to Beth Walker, a Charleston, South Carolina native I had met 5 years earlier. Denver fell in love with her as well, and after nearly a year of dating, he blessed our marriage. During that year of courtship, Beth and I lost count of late-night trips to the emergency room and days spent in the hospital with him. After 25 years of despair on the streets, for the last 9 years he finally possessed a will to live and make a difference. But he had always told me since the day he moved into my home that to live is to suffer and to die is gain. He began to visit old friends and family and told me often how much he loved and appreciated me and my family. He returned regularly to Louisiana to visit and bless his aunt, who was more than 100 years old and still living in plantation-style poverty. On his last visit to her, He fell asleep at the wheel on Interstate 20 across the median, nearly missing a head-on collision with an 18-wheeler. The next morning, as I walked into my kitchen to make coffee, he was sitting very alert at the breakfast table.
"Mr. Ron, you are looking at a walking dead man," he said as he broke into a laugh.
"Really? How is that?" He began to tell the story of his falling asleep at the wheel only a few hours earlier and waking up to the headlights and the sound of a horn blasting from an approaching 18-wheeler. He swerved to narrowly miss certain death and landed in the grassy ravine alongside the interstate. A concerned citizen who had witnessed the whole mess stopped and ran up to Denver's Escalade and asked if he was okay. Denver assured him he had not had a heart attack, but had just fallen asleep at the wheel, then proceeded to inform the concerned citizen that a spiritual being was riding in the front seat with him and was his protector and savior. The man told him frankly, "Sir, I can tell you for a fact it was not Jesus, because I saw him jump out of the car as you were about to crash into that big truck, because he thought you were trying to kill him." Denver broke into such a gasping laughter telling me the story that I feared the possibility of him having a heart attack right there in my kitchen. A few days later, we were packing to go to Rocky Top for our annual Cowboy Spring Gathering. He said he was too tired and would drive out later that day. When he did not show up, I called, and he assured me he would leave early the next morning, as he did not want to miss seeing all his cowboy friends. When he failed to show, I called and called to no answer. About midnight, I received the call I never wanted to receive. The following is his obituary I wrote on March 31st, 2012. Denver T. Moore, January 30th, 1937, March 31st, 2012. The gates of heaven swung open on Saturday, March 31st, and Denver went walking in. He had sung those words of his favorite old spiritual countless times, receiving standing ovations all across America. He dreamed of heaven and was ready to go join the saints and be reunited with Miss Debbie, the woman who dreamed he would make a difference. He was 75 years old. Though his lips were always flapping like Bible pages, he used to say he never claimed to be a preacher, just a sinner saved by grace with a message of hope for those that didn't have any. His story, well known by millions, is told in Same Kind of Different as Me, a word-of-mouth best-selling book that spent 3.5 years on the New York Times bestseller list. His follow-up book, What Difference Do It Make?, tells the rest. Denver, an ex-con and formerly homeless man, spent much of his life on the streets of Fort Worth, Texas, until Deborah Hall, Miss Debbie to him, dreamed he was a poor man with wisdom that would change the city. And did he ever? A few years after that dream, he was honored as the philanthropist of the year for his work on behalf of the homeless in Fort Worth. That day, he repeated his transformation story that he had told on the Tavis Smiley Show on PBS. "God is in the recycling business," he said. "What most folks in Fort Worth thought was trash on the streets, God turned into a treasure." Amen to that. In 2007, Barbara Bush selected Same Kind of Different as Me to be featured at her Celebration of Reading fundraisers in Dallas and Washington, D.C. Denver was honored to meet the president and attend a private luncheon at the White House